Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding by David Hume, first published in 1748. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Section 8, Liberty and Necessity, Part 1. In questions that have been eagerly discussed and disputed since science and philosophy first began, it might reasonably be expected that the disputants would at least have agreed on the meanings of all the terms, so that in the course of 2,000 years we could get away from verbal disputes and come to the true and real subject of the controversy. Isn't it easy enough to give exact definitions of the terms used in reasoning, and then focus our attention on these definitions rather than on the mere sound of the words? But if we look more closely, we'll be inclined to think that this is not what happens. If a controversy has kept going for a long time and is still undecided, that alone tells us that there is some ambiguity in how the disputants express themselves, and that they assign different ideas to the words used in the controversy. Here is the basis for this presumption. The intellects of human beings are supposed to be naturally alike, and if they weren't, there would be no point in reasoning or disputing together. So if men attached the same ideas to the words they use, they couldn't go on for so long forming different opinions of the same subject, especially when they communicate their views to one another, and cast about in every direction for arguments that may defeat their opponents. Admittedly, if men try to discuss questions that lie right outside the reach of human capacity, such as those concerning the origin of worlds or the workings of the domain of spirits, they may for a long time beat the air in their fruitless contests and never arrive at any definite conclusion. But when the question concerns any subject of common life and experience, the only thing that could keep the dispute alive for a long time is, one would think, some ambiguous expressions that keep the antagonists at a distance and prevent them from coming to grips with each other. That's what has been happening in the long dispute about liberty and necessity. I think we shall find that all people, both learned and ignorant, have always had the same view about liberty and necessity, although they have differed in how they expressed it, and have thus seemed to be in disagreement. I think that a few intelligible definitions would have immediately put an end to the whole controversy. This dispute has been so vigorous and widespread, and has led philosophers into such a labyrinth of obscure sophistry, that it would be understandable if a reader saved himself trouble by refusing to listen to any side in a debate that he can't expect to find instructive or interesting. But perhaps he will return to it, given my account of how the debate stands. My account has more novelty than its predecessors, promises at least some resolution of the controversy, and won't put him to much trouble by any intricate or obscure reasoning. That is my project, then, to show that all men have always agreed about both necessity and liberty, when those terms are taken in any reasonable sense, and that the whole controversy until now has turned merely on words. I shall begin by examining the doctrine of necessity. Everyone agrees that matter, in all its operations, is driven by a necessary force, and that every natural effect is so exactly determined by the energy of its cause, that in those particular circumstances no other effect could possibly have resulted from that cause. The laws of nature prescribe the speed and direction of every motion so exactly that the collision of two bodies has to produce motion with precisely the speed and direction that it does in fact produce. It could no more have resulted in any other motion than it could have resulted in the formation of a living creature. So if we want to get a correct and precise idea of necessity, we must consider where that idea comes from, when we apply it to the operation of bodies. It seems obvious that if all the scenes of nature were continually changed in such a way that no two events bore any resemblance to each other, so that every event was entirely new and had no likeness to anything that had been seen before, we would never have acquired the slightest idea of necessity, or of a connection among these objects. We might then say that one object or event has followed another, but not that one was produced by the other. The relation of cause and effect would have to be utterly unknown to mankind. Inference and reasoning about the operations of nature would come to a halt, and knowledge of any real existence would have to come through the senses and memory. This shows that our idea of necessity and causation arises entirely from the uniformity we observe in the operations of nature, where similar items are constantly conjoined, and the mind is determined by custom to infer one from the appearance of the other. The necessity that we ascribe to matter consists only in those two, the constant conjunction of similar objects, and the consequent inference from one to the other. Apart from these, we have no notion of necessity or connection. If it turns out that all mankind have always held, without any doubt or hesitation, that these two factors are present in the voluntary actions of men and in the operations of minds, i.e., that like is followed by like, and that we are disposed to make inferences on that basis, it follows that all mankind have always agreed in the doctrine of necessity, and have been disputing simply because they didn't understand each other. Here are some points that may satisfy you concerning the constant and regular conjunction of similar events. Everyone acknowledges that there is much uniformity among the actions of men in all nations and ages, and that human nature remains the same in its forces and operations. The same motives always produce the same actions. The same events follow from the same causes. Ambition, avarice, self-love, vanity, friendship, generosity, public spirit, these passions, variously mixed and distributed, are and always have been the source of all the actions and projects of mankind. Do you want to know the feelings, inclinations, and course of life of the ancient Greeks and Romans? Then study well the character and actions of the French and English. Most of what you see in them can be transferred, without much error, to the ancients. Mankind are so much the same in all times and places, that history informs us of nothing new or strange on this topic. The chief use of history is only to reveal the constant and universal drivers of human nature, by showing men in all kinds of circumstances and situations, and providing us with materials from which we can form our observations and encounter the usual sources of human action and behaviour. These records of wars, intrigues, factions, and revolutions are so many sets of data that the political theorist or moral philosopher uses to fix the principles of his science, just as the natural scientist learns the nature of plants, minerals, and other external objects by the tests he puts them through. The men described by Polybius and Tacitus resemble those who now govern the world as closely as the earth, water, and other elements examined by Aristotle and Hippocrates resemble those we now encounter. If a traveller returning from a distant country were to bring us an account of men wholly different from any we had ever encountered, men with no trace of greed, ambition, or vengefulness, knowing no pleasure except friendship, generosity, and public spirit, we would immediately detect the falsehood, and would judge him to be a liar, just as confidently as if he had filled his report with stories of centaurs and dragons, miracles and prodigies. And when we want to expose an historical document as a forgery, we can't make use of a more convincing argument than to show that the actions ascribed to some person in the document are directly contrary to the course of nature, and that no human motives in such circumstances could ever lead him to behave in that way. If we have a long life, and a variety of business and social contacts with other people, this experience is beneficial in teaching us the general principles of human nature, and guiding us in our future conduct as well as in our theory building. Guided by this experience, we infer upwards from men's actions, expressions, and even gestures to their inclinations and motives, and in the downward direction, we interpret and predict their actions on the basis of our knowledge of their motives and inclinations. The general observations that we store up through a lifetime's experience give us the clue to human nature, and teach us to disentangle all its intricacies. Pretences and mere show no longer deceive us, and though we allow virtue and honour their due weight and authority, the perfect unselfishness that people so often lay claim to is something we never expect in multitudes and parties, seldom in their leaders, and barely even in individuals in any social class. But if there were no uniformity in human actions, if the outcomes of all our tests of these matters were irregular and anomalous, we couldn't possibly assemble any general observations concerning mankind, and no experience, however thoughtfully pondered, would ever serve any purpose. But we mustn't expect this uniformity of human actions to be so complete that all men in the same circumstances will always act in precisely the same way, for that wouldn't allow for differences among characters, prejudices, and opinions. Such complete uniformity is never found in nature. On the contrary, from observing the variety of conduct in different men, we are enabled to form a greater variety of generalizations, which still presuppose a degree of uniformity and regularity underlying the variety. Does the behavior of men differ in different ages and countries? That teaches us the power of custom and education, which mould the human mind from its infancy, and form it into a fixed and established character. Is the conduct of one sex very unlike that of the other? From that we learn the different characters that nature has given to the sexes, and preserved in them with constancy and regularity. Are the actions of one person very different in the different periods of his life from infancy to old age? This invites many general observations about the gradual change of our feelings and inclinations, and the different patterns that human creatures conform to at different ages. Even the characteristics that are special to each individual have a uniformity in their influence. Otherwise, our acquaintance with the individuals and our observation of their conduct could never teach us what their dispositions are, or help us to know how to behave towards them. I admit that we may encounter some actions that seem to have no regular connection with any known motives, and are exceptions to all the patterns of conduct that have ever been established as governing human behavior. But if we want to know what to think about such irregular and extraordinary actions, we might consider the view that is commonly taken of irregular events that do not involve human beings. All causes are not conjoined to their usual effects with the same uniformity. A carpenter may be thwarted in what he is trying to do by something unexpected in the dead material he is working on, just as a politician, directing the conduct of thinking and feeling agents, can be thwarted by something unexpected in the people he wants to control. Common people, who judge things by their first appearance, explain these unexpected outcomes in terms of an intrinsic uncertainty in the causes. They think that a cause may fail to have its usual effects, not because there are obstacles to its doing so, but because the cause itself is weak. But scientists, observing that in most parts of nature there are vastly many different triggers and causes that are too small or too distant for us to find them, judge that it's at least possible that irregularities come not from causes being weak, but from the secret operation of contrary causes. This possibility is converted into certainty when, by further careful observation, they discover that in each of these cases some contrary cause was indeed at work, producing the irregularity. A peasant can give no better reason for a clock's stopping than to say that it often does not go right. But a clockmaker easily sees that the same force in the spring or pendulum has always the same influence on the wheels, but one time fails to have its usual effect, because a grain of dust, perhaps, has put a stop to the whole movement. From observing a number of parallel instances, scientists arrive at the maxim that the connection between all causes and effects is equally necessary, and that its seeming uncertainty in some instances comes from the secret opposition of contrary causes. In the human body, for instance, when the usual symptoms of health or sickness are not as we expect, when medicines don't operate with their usual effect, when some cause leads irregularly to different effects, the scientist and the physician aren't surprised by this. and are never tempted to deny the necessity and uniformity of the forces that govern the animal system. They know that a human body is an enormously complicated machine, that many secret powers lurk in it, that we have no hope of understanding, that to us it must often appear very uncertain in its operations, and that therefore its internal operations and control systems may conform to the laws of nature with great regularity, despite the irregular events that outwardly appear. The scientist, if he is consistent, must apply the same reasoning to the actions and decisions of thinking agents. The most irregular and unexpected decisions of men may often be explained by those who know every particular circumstance of their character and situation. A normally obliging person gives an irritable answer, but he has a toothache, or hasn't dined and is hungry. A sluggish fellow shows an unusual briskness in his step, but he has met with a sudden piece of good fortune. Sometimes a person acts in a way that neither he nor anyone else can explain, but we know in a general way that the characters of men are somewhat inconstant and irregular. This inconstancy is, in a way, the constant character of human nature, though there is more of it in some persons, ones who have no fixed rule for their conduct and frequently act in a capricious and inconstant manner. Even in these people, the internal forces and motives may operate in a uniform manner, despite these seeming irregularities, just as the winds, rain, clouds, and other variations of the weather are supposed to be governed by unchanging forces, though our skill and hard work can't easily tell us what they are. Thus, it appears not only that the relation of motives to voluntary actions is as regular and uniform as that of cause to effect in any other part of nature, but also that this regular relation has been universally acknowledged among mankind, and has never been the subject of dispute in science or in common life. Now, it is from past experience that we draw all our conclusions about the future. And in these inferences, we conclude that objects we have always found to be conjoined will always be so in the future. So it may seem superfluous to argue that our conclusions about human actions are based on the uniformity we have found them to have. But I shall do so, though briefly, so as to show my overall position from a different angle. In all societies, people depend so much on one another that hardly any human action is entirely complete in itself, or performed without reference to the actions of others that are needed for the action to produce the intended result. The poorest workman, who labours alone, still expects at least the protection of the law to guarantee him the enjoyment of the fruits of his labour. He also expects that when he takes his goods to market and offers them at a reasonable price, he will find buyers, and will be able through his earnings to get others to supply him with what he needs for his subsistence. The more wide-ranging and complicated a man's dealings with others are, the more his way of life involves voluntary actions by other people, things people do from their motives, but which he expects to cooperate with his. In arriving at these expectations, he goes by past experience, in the same manner as in his reasonings about external objects, and he firmly believes that men, as well as all the kinds of stuff, will continue to behave in the ways that he has found them to do. A manufacturer relies on the labour of his employees for getting a job done, as much as he relies on the tools that he provides for them, and he would be equally surprised if either the men or the tools disappointed his expectations. In short, this empirical inference and reasoning about the actions of others enters so much into human life that every man is engaged in it at every waking moment. Isn't this a reason to affirm that all mankind have always agreed in the doctrine of necessity, according to my account of it? Nor have philosophers or scientists ever thought differently about this. Almost every action of their life presupposes the common people's opinion, which is also essential to most branches of learning. What would become of history if we didn't, on the basis of our experience of mankind, depend on the truthfulness of the historian? How could politics be a science if laws and forms of government didn't have a uniform influence on society? Where would the foundation of morals be, if people's characters had no certain or determinate power to produce sentiments, feelings, and opinions, or if these sentiments had no constant effect on actions? And what could entitle us to pass critical judgment on any dramatic poet or author, if we couldn't say whether the conduct and sentiments of his actors were natural for such characters in such circumstances? It seems almost impossible, therefore, to engage either in learning or in action of any kind without acknowledging the doctrine of necessity, and this inference from motives to voluntary actions, from characters to conduct. And indeed, when we consider how aptly we can form a single chain of argument involving both human nature and other parts of the natural world, we shan't hesitate to agree that these two are of the same nature and driven by the same forces. A prisoner who has neither money nor influence can't escape, and he sees that he can't, when he considers not only the walls and bars he is surrounded by, but also the obstinacy of the jailer, and in trying to escape, he chooses to work on the stone and iron of the former, rather than on the inflexible nature of the latter. The same prisoner, when led to the scaffold, foresees his death as certainly from the constancy and fidelity of his guards as from the operation of the axe. If an intimate friend of mine, whom I know to be honest and wealthy, comes into my house where I am surrounded by my servants, I rest assured that he isn't going to stab me in order to steal my silver inkwell, and I no more suspect such behaviour from him than I expect the collapse of the house itself, which is new, solidly built, and well-founded. You may object. But he may have been seized with a sudden and unknown frenzy, in which case he may attack and steal from you. I reply, a sudden earthquake may start up and shake and tumble my house about my ears. The two possibilities are still on a par, though admittedly they are not examples of absolute certainty. Very well, I shall change the examples. I shall say that I know with certainty that my friend will not put his hand into the fire and hold it there until it is consumed. No suspicion of an unknown frenzy can give the least possibility to this, which is so contrary to all the known principles of human nature. I can be as confident of this as I can that if my friend throws himself out of the window and meets with no obstruction, he won't remain for a moment suspended in the air. I've often wondered why all mankind, though they unhesitatingly acknowledge in all their behaviour and reasoning that human conduct is governed by necessity, have shown so much reluctance to accept this in words, and all through the centuries have tended to proclaim the contrary opinion. Here is what I think may be the explanation. If we examine the operations of inanimate bodies, and the production in them of effects from their causes, we shall find that the most we can know about this cause-effect relation is merely that particular objects constantly go together, and that our mind is carried by a customary transition from the appearance of one to the expectation of the other. This conclusion concerning a limit on human knowledge is the result of the strictest scrutiny of this subject, which I have conducted, and yet men are still very inclined to think that they can penetrate further into the powers of nature, and perceive something like a necessary connection between the cause and the effect. When they turn their reflections back towards the operations of their own minds, and feel no such connection between the motive and the action, they are inclined to infer that the effects arising from thought and intelligence are unlike those resulting from material force. But once we are convinced that all we know of causation of any kind is merely the constant conjunction of objects and the consequent inference of the mind from one to the other, and have grasped that these two are agreed by everyone to occur in voluntary actions, we may be more inclined to admit that the same necessity is common to all causes. And though this reasoning may contradict the systems of many philosophers by ascribing necessity to the decisions of the will, we shall find when we think about it that they disagree with it only in words, and not in their real beliefs. Necessity, in the sense I have been giving the word, has never yet been rejected, and I don't think it ever could be rejected by any philosopher. Someone wanting to reject it would have to claim that the mind can perceive in the operations of matter some further connection between cause and effect, and that no such connection occurs in the voluntary actions of thinking beings. Now, whether this is right can only appear on examination of the empirical facts, and the onus is on these philosophers to justify their assertion by defining or describing that connection and pointing it out to us in the operations of material causes. It would seem, indeed, that men begin at the wrong end of this question about liberty and necessity when they start in on it by examining the faculties of the mind, the influence of the understanding, and the operations of the will. They should at first investigate a simpler topic, namely the operations of body and of brute unthinking matter, and see whether they can form any idea of causation and necessity there, except that of constantly conjoined objects, and an inference of the mind from one to the other. If there is nothing to the necessity that we conceive in matter, except the conjunction and the inference, and if these are also universally agreed to occur in the operations of the mind, the dispute is at an end. Or if it continues, it should be admitted to be merely verbal. But as long as we rashly suppose that we have some further idea of necessity and causation in the operations of external objects, while finding nothing further in the voluntary actions of the mind, we can't possibly resolve the issue. The only way out of this error is to examine the narrow extent of our knowledge relating to material causes, and to convince ourselves that all we know of such causes is the above-mentioned constant conjunction and inference. It may be hard for us to accept that human understanding has such narrow limits, but we shall afterwards have no difficulty in applying this doctrine to the actions of the will. For as it is evident that these actions have a regular conjunction with motives and circumstances and characters, and as we always draw inferences from latter to the former, we ought to acknowledge in words the necessity that we already admit in all our practical thinking and in every step of our conduct and behaviour. I shan't need many words to prove that all mankind have always agreed about liberty, as well as about necessity, and that the whole dispute about liberty has been merely verbal. For what is meant by liberty when the term is applied to voluntary actions? Surely we can't mean that actions have so little connection with motives, inclinations, and circumstances that the former don't follow with some uniformity from the latter, and that motives, etc., support no inference by which we can infer actions. For these, the uniformity and the inference, are plain and acknowledged matters of fact. By liberty, then, we can only mean a power of acting or not acting according to the determinations of the will, i.e., if we choose to stay still, we may do so, and if we choose to move, we may do that. This hypothetical liberty, hypothetical, because it concerns what we may do if we so choose, is universally agreed to belong to everyone who isn't a prisoner and in chains. There's nothing to disagree about here. Whatever definition we may give of liberty, we should be careful to ensure, firstly, that it is consistent with plain matter of fact, and secondly, that it is consistent with itself. If we observe these two constraints, and make our definition intelligible, I am sure that all mankind will be found to have the same opinion about it. Everyone agrees that nothing exists without a cause of its existence, and that chance is a mere negative word that doesn't stand for any real power existing anywhere in nature. But it is claimed that some causes are necessary, while others are not. Here, then, is the advantage of definitions. Let anyone define a cause in such a way that a necessary connection with its effect isn't included in the definition, and let him show clearly the origin of the idea expressed by his definition, and I shall readily give up the whole controversy. But if my account of causation is right, there's absolutely no chance of making and defending such a definition. If objects didn't have a regular conjunction with each other, we would never have had any notion of cause and effect, and this regular conjunction leads us to make the inference that is the only connection we can understand. Whoever attempts a definition of cause in terms of something other than regular conjunction and subsequent inference will be obliged to employ terms that are either unintelligible or synonymous with the term he is trying to define. End of Section 8, Part 1.